shoot our shot and cast with plot. Then we saddle up and counter gain. Thunder Junction every night joins Annie, Kellen, and I. Every night to sit in Lone Arroyo and wash Oco, tell the sheriff to reach for the sky. We know no one belongs to the land.
That is gold.
And the land no one belongs to is grand.
It's ours now.
Ours, 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 ours. And when we say
it's free,
thunder, 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 thunder. We know no one belongs to the land, and the land no one belongs to is grand. And when we say
spree,
a spree, a yowie, yay, we're only saying you're doing crimes. Thunder Junction, Thunder Junction, Thunder Junction. Thunder.
Whenever you want. This is great. I'm going to sit back and just do nothing.
Okie doke. Howdy, y'all, and welcome to another episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Parker Lamascus, taking over because I've got with me Anthony Pretty Boy Maddox and Andy Machine Gun Mangold. Welcome to the show, boys. It's Wild West edition.
Did they have machine guns in the Wild West? I'm just picturing six shooters, not machine guns.
Technically, Machine Gun Kelly is Australian, not at all Western.
Right, and also he lives right now and not in the Old West, and he's also a musical artist.
What? No. He's no. The musical artist is named after the criminal who was Australian.
There was an actual criminal, not
criminal. Criminal.
There was an actual criminal. It's not just the musical artist Machine Gun Kelly.
Yes, it was a historical figure first. But I figured I couldn't think of a better nickname for you as... Machine Gun does describe the speed and pace of your talking, my good friend.
Were we supposed to do voices too?
This is funny. You just announced when we got on the call that you were going to do the intros, which I'm very grateful for. And I also had picked out nicknames for both of you based on famous nicknames of Western outlaws. But the two I picked out was Rattlesnake Dick and Little Dick, which are two good nicknames for famous outlaws. You know, just a short guy named Richard, a.k.a. Little Dick.
Which of us is Rattlesnake Dick?
Well, I was going to make you Rattlesnake Dick, Anthony, just so I could bury the Little Dick lead, you know?
Even though I am taller.
You are taller, yeah. There was
Wait,
another
really?
One. Yeah, he's definitely taller than you, yeah.
Huh. I never noticed.
What?
Unfortunately.
What is his bit?
That's just sincere.
He's much taller. He's like taller than me. How
really?
Tall are you, Parker?
6'1" and
yeah.
change.
How, you're that tall?
Yes, he's tall.
What the heck?
I guess he's about as tall as me. I always think people are... I always think I'm shorter than I am is a recurring bit for me.
The things you learn while doing a podcast remotely.
Anyway, I think your nicknames were better, and I learned a lot about Machine Gun Kelly today.
The real question is, what is my real voice? Is this it? Or is my everyday voice? You know, what is the mm-hmm. the feigned
right.
accent?
Classic,
this,
classic Superman.
Is
Superman
my
is
other
Clark
voice.
Kent is Superman's judgment of humanity.
Yeah, maybe I'm faking all the time, mm-hmm. and this is the only time I've been for real this whole time.
He's constantly tone-switching, trying to blend in with his environment. When he's talking to us, when he's talking to us East Coast elitists, he puts on airs of not being a good old down south boy.
Exactly. Yes, I am, you know, from Oklahoma, if people don't know this already. I also think they will have heard the musical intro to this show. My wife, Kennedy, wants you to know that she is taking commissions. She is open for work for any magical parodies. I don't know if she's really open for work, but she did want me to shout her out. So.
Hey, look, everybody's open for work at all times. It's just a question of price. So the question is, how much is she going to charge UberCube or whatever magic podcast that wants to hire her to make a magic parody intro?
Absolutely.
I think you should also say who you are. I mean, not to pull the curtain back too far, but you're not normally on the podcast. So even though you're doing the intro, I think you should maybe introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. Let me first figure out... Oh,
don't we already know that he's
it's doing
Rattlesnake Dick?
Background noise removal, and I need to turn that off because I can't hear y'all. So anyways, my name's Parker Lamascus. I am the editor of the Lucky Paper website, And, you know, I do the data analysis for our community set reviews. And as the only authentic Western individual in this group, I led the charge on this particular episode. But here we are to talk about Thunder Junction and the Cube community's response to that set.
I like you just saying the phrase data analysis in that accent. It's very anachronistic to hear that.
I do my best. Thank you very much.
And here we'll take a look at the standard deviation.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I mean, if you want to do an academic talk afterwards, I can talk to y'all about elastohydrodynamic lubrication and all of the, you know, tribological things that that implies.
You're right. You should totally be Slippery Dick Lemascus, not not Little Dick or Rattlesnake Dick.
Well, yes, I guess you got me pegged.
Oh, I can think of places I can go with that. Let's just keep moving on.
Okay. Well, let's light a shuck and get right into it then. Thunder Junction. This is the latest Magic set, and for every one of our community set reviews, we ask our respondents two questions. What cards from the new set are you testing in your cube or battle box or whatever? And how excited are you about those cards? And we ask that on a scale of 1 to 10 by whatever metric the user wants, whether that's power level or artistic qualities or just the synergies of the cards. We don't really care. We just want to know, scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not very excited and 10 being extremely excited. How excited are you for each card that you're testing? Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. Yeah, this is purely subjective. It's entirely up to whatever your own personal cube design parameters are. So we have some respondents that have cubes that have aesthetic limitations, that have cubes that are limited to card names, that have alliteration, all kinds of restrictions there. So this is purely just about each individual person's personal design goals. And then what we look at in the aggregate is the cards that just fit the most people's design goals.
That's right. So for Outlaws of Thunder Junction, we've got about 170, 180 testers at this time. I think the link will remain open for another week, so, you know, that number may change. But Outlaws of Thunder Junction is similar to Murders at Karlov Manor, the most recent set before it. It has about 180 testers at this time, and a median of 9 cards being tested by our respondents. So this is not a super popular set. And in particular, there's no card that really captures over half or anything close to half of our respondents. I don't really know why that is. It may be that the theme is unpopular, as my accent might be at this time with some of our listeners. But it might also just be a function of the power level and so on.
I'm not sure. I mean, I like to think that this is just the ongoing trend of people's cube design sensibilities broadening and more people embracing the idea of designing cubes that are not just, you know, collections of iconic, powerful cards. I'm not sure if that's the case. That's purely hypothetical, but I like to think that's what it is, that we see this continued diversification of popular cards. Because, yeah, I mean, the top cards here, there's two that are above like a quarter of our testers, and they're both a little over a third, which is not super high, and some of these cards, if you're just going on pure power level, I think are some of the best we've seen in years for cubes. So I don't know what it is, but I'm encouraged by it.
Yeah, maybe that's right. I don't know. I'm also personally feeling some amount of fatigue with this release in particular. I just don't feel that.
Oh, not
I
us. Anthony and I are feeling great about it, so you're the odd man out for feeling fatigued by this set.
Well, yeah, I just don't know. I don't have the same energy to update this when I have barely even acquired cards from Murders at Karlov Manor. So, you know, I'm not testing much, and I wonder if that is at all representative of the broader Magic community, but, you know, I don't want to extrapolate too far, of course.
You know what they say about assumptions.
Something about an ass out of you and me.
Whoa, whoa, no swearing here, Slippery Dick.
Oh, my.
Watch that language. You're getting mighty blue.
We're going to get some mail after this episode, I think.
Nah, no, we're not. So, we're going to talk about the top 10 cards from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, and we are including the big score in this top 10 cards. There are quite a few cards from the big score that are very popular amongst our respondents, so that's exciting to see. it's still, I'll be perfectly honest, the big score, these are just cards you can open in regular packs. That's the only way you get them. There's not, it's not like a separate product or anything.
That's correct.
Okay.
As far as I know, at least.
So yeah, we're covering the top 10, which is all of the cards that got more than 1/5 or 20% of our respondents saying they are testing them. But there are plenty of cards just under that and a very long tail of other mediumly popular cards. So as always, we will point people to the article on our website with the full analysis to dive in and take a deeper look at the at these responses, because we can only cover so many on the podcast episode, but there is a ton here for you to sink your teeth into if you want to know more about people's analysis of this set.
And I guess before we move on, this set has a wealth of information written about it besides just the official review. Our good friend Usman Jamil has written, I'm sorry, Usman, for the way I just said your name. But
Usman Jamil.
Yeah, it was about five words there crammed into just his name. But anyways, Usman has written an excellent set review from his own perspective, focused a little bit on how we test these cards and playtest data or playtest indications from his own playgroup. So it's a really good look at how a veteran cube designer goes about testing a new set. And it's available at this time as well. I may have, depending on how vexed I am at this set, I may have written a philosophical rant about the world and the setting, in particular why I don't really like the world and the setting. So that may also be available for your reading pleasure.
I look forward to reading that whenever you finish it. And, you know, you're putting it on this podcast now, so there is an additional pressure to maybe get it done before next Monday. We also had a pretty good hot take sent in by Trainmaster GT regarding the set's flavor that I'll insert in the episode now.
Outlaws of Thunder Junction is really confusing. In an attempt to make a set that wasn't offensive, Wizards of the Coast accidentally stumbled into a bunch of stereotypes that tend to be very problematic. The result is a world that just doesn't make sense. The history of settler colonialism can be a very difficult subject to broach in fantasy. Telling a story about settler colonialism, and especially the conflict between indigenous peoples and colonizers, can be very difficult for creators of fantasy, especially when the goal is to focus on a colonizing group and not the natives. It's not exactly uncommon to accidentally portray a native group as savage or uncivilized, even when that is not the intention of the creator. To avoid any controversy, the creative team behind Thunder Junction decided to make the plain of Thunder Junction completely empty before the Omen Paths arrived and allowed the first immigrants to start flooding in. Unfortunately, this decision accidentally reinforces a harmful trope that has been plaguing our representation of North America in popular culture since the very beginning, Terra Nullius. When the first Christian explorers arrived in the New World in the late 1400s, they declared it Terra Nullius, because even though there were people living there, they weren't Christians, and thus were not human. This assertion that Native Americans weren't really people and didn't deserve the same rights and protections afforded to Europeans has played a key factor in the continued disenfranchisement of Native Americans. It's very unfortunate that this was the direction Wizards of the Coast decided to take the world building, because not only is it somewhat problematic from a historical standpoint, but it has also just irreparably damaged the world of Thunder Junction from a story perspective. A lot of the issues with the world feeling like a quote-unquote holodeck is a result of the fact that it has no history beyond the roughly 1 to 2 years since the Omen Paths first opened. The plain is described as being completely uninhabited and unsettled, with no pre-existing structures except for the one Fomori vault at the center of the plain. This isn't an inherently bad idea for a story, but things start to fall apart when you realize that the plain is littered with old mining communities and boom towns that have clearly been abandoned for more than the 1 to 2 years that would make sense in the story timeline up to this point. The lack of existing inhabitants also makes certain other design decisions very weird. For example, the fact that everybody is wearing a cowboy hat would actually make sense if there was an existing culture on the plain. After all, ever since the cowboy hat was first invented in 1865, basically everyone out west would be wearing one, as they were a great way to both protect yourself from the sun and the rain since they were waterproof. The problem is, since Thunder Junction has no previous inhabitants, there's just no reason why anyone would have cowboy hats. They probably weren't invented unless some other western plane exists that we've never seen before. Obviously, that would have required showing the cowboys as being indigenous to the plane, but I don't necessarily think that is a problem if the issue your plane is suffering from is there's no history here. Perhaps they could have had both cowboys and Native Americans on the same world. It's weird, too, because they clearly wanted to have some Native representation in the set. For example, the Atin are nomads from another plane who apparently have been spending the last 1 to 2 years roaming around the multiverse using the Omen Paths. The problem is, by having them not be native to Thunder Junction, they're just another group of immigrants. So it's like they're kind of trying to have their cake and eat it in the fact that there isn't any settler colonialism going on that's negatively impacting a native group, but there are still natives in the set. Even the Scorpion Dragon, something that is seemingly purpose-built for Thunder Junction, aren't actually native to the plane, at least according to one member of the Magic Story team on the website formerly known as Twitter. Instead, they're from an obscure old plane called Gastal, which Urza once visited during the Shard of 12 Worlds era. All of these issues with the setting of Thunder Junction are a real shame, because I think they actually did a good job with a number of the other elements in the world building. Seeing the biodiversity of North America on Magic cards is really cool, and I'm happy that we have cards with prairie dogs and coyotes on them now. It's awesome. I think they also did a great job with the villain portion of the set. It's very clear that they have been trying to make a villain's Magic set for the past 10 years, because these are some of the most well thought out and interesting parts of the story. But the fact that the plane doesn't have an existing history before the last couple of years means that the set ends up feeling less like awesome villains in the West set and more like Commander Legends in the Desert. If the Plane of Thunder Junction itself had had a better history, maybe it wouldn't feel this way. In my opinion, it has the best slate of new mechanics in a long time and has a lot of interesting, powerful, and fun cards to explore, especially for cube designers. But I think the botched world building has turned off a lot of people to what would otherwise be an all-time greatest set. Unfortunately, we were left with Magic villains on the holodeck, which is just really disappointing. Hot take, I think the trains on this plane make zero sense. I really wish they had just gone with regular steam engines, since the fuel sources that we've seen for other trains in the multiverse at this point don't seem to be naturally occurring on Thunder Junction. It just seems like bad world building to me.
So suffice it to say that we are not the only ones feeling a little jaded, feeling like maybe the flavor here was a little bit of a miss or a little shallow for its intended subject matter.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts on it, and, you know, if our listeners would rather skip this, then there are timestamps in the show notes. But to me, I understand where Wizards was coming from, wanting to avoid some of the messy history of the American West, and in particular, the general horrible conduct of the newcomers to America. I get why they'd want to sidestep that, and so instead they've clearly signaled through the humor and references of this set that this is not a set about the historical American West. It is a set about, essentially, Fortnite characters in cowboy hats, which, I gotta say, is just kind of hack, and I don't particularly love that. At least they were clear. It's kitschy and lame, and I don't think it's particularly funny, but at least it's not, well, I don't know. This is why you gotta read the article, I guess.
It might not be good, but at least it's grasping at straws.
We've had episodes before talking about the definition of art. I look forward to our episode in the future discussing the definition of comedy and why some cards are funny and other cards are not.
Fortunately, Mark Rosewater has already done many episodes of Drive to Work on why it's really difficult to define comedy, so go check that out.
I guess it's that the cards in this set, you have to make them funny, right? Because if you don't, then that invites questions of, oh, are we treating this historical subject seriously? And if so, why are there no Native Americans in this set? So you have to make it funny, and you have to include Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner and all the rest. But it does then invite this critique where it does look like a Fortnite set, and you've just got all your cameos and, you know, your Marvel-ass storyline and ridiculous comic book narrative. And so, sure, you manage to not be serious and kind of evade the questions of genocide and Native erasure, but at the same time, that means that the set can't be taken seriously in some ways, which is, I guess, where I'm at with this. I do like some individual cards, but overall, I'm really not impressed. And that comes from somebody who's currently making a bit out of the cowboy accent. I love a good cowboy joke. This is not a good cowboy joke.
But what you're doing is a good cowboy joke, and we will not be taking questions on this. Questions or comments welcome on the comedic virtue of Parker's bit.
Thank you.
It's Andy in the old editing booth. The other hot takes we got about this set just all pertain to cards that were not in the top 10, so they're not about the cards we're discussing in this episode, so I'm just going to drop them all here. Maybe just another testament to the fact that people's tastes towards Cube are broadening, the horizons are expanding, and the possibilities are infinite.
My hot take for Outlaws of Thunder Junction is the card Servant of the Stinger. If you're in a lower powered or budget environment that normally precludes tutors, this card is a great option. It's a great defensive option. Historically, most 1/3s with Death Touch have been 3 mana or gold, so it's a great poor man's The Abyss, since it can eat bears for days. But on offense, there are few boards where your opponent could profitably block it, and there's so much risk associated with letting it through if you've committed a crime this turn. Especially if you support ninjas or small stuff or animator, I highly recommend this card. In testing, it's already proven far better than it looks.
My favorite card of the set is Wily Duke, 18 euro. I really love this card. It comes with a little puzzle. It's a 4/2 vigilance that draws you a card when it becomes tapped. How do you make it tapped? Depending on your environment, it can be wacky, weird interaction, can be piloting vehicles. It depends, but it's really a puzzle that you need to solve in deck building, and I love it. The 4/2 body prevents it from being too oppressive, I think. And even though it will not make the cut in Vintage and Legacy Cube, probably, for other cubes, it's a nice piece of design that will make your curators and players think outside of the box.
Should we jump into some cards then?
I think we should. So, again, we're looking at the top 10 here, starting with number 10, and that is Phantom Interference. This is one of the spree cards, so the base mana cost is blue, but for blue you're not getting anything except your foot in the door for these other modes.
You can't even cast it just for blue.
Correct. I think the main mode of this card is going to be blue plus one, so one and a blue, to counter-target spell unless its controller pays two. So your classic quench. And the upside on this one is that the additional mode for another 3 generic mana will create a 2/2 white spirit creature token with flying. And as a reminder, with Spree, you can do both or just one or the other. So this can either be a 4-mana 2/2 flyer with flash, or a quench, or both for a grand total of 5 mana. This is being tested by 21.3% of our respondents at time of recording, with a rating of 6.4, which is actually relatively low, and we'll see as we go up this list that there are many even much lower average ratings here among our top 10, much lower than we see typically in a set review like this.
Yeah, I'm surprised to see this low rating on a card that is tested by so many people. I wonder if it's sort of in this strange in-between space where a lot of the cards that we see often at the top of the list are cards that have some level of familiarity that people sort of know how to expect from them. We don't see a lot of cards that are like totally new designs that are people don't really know how to evaluate. So the fact that this on its baseline is like a quench with a little bit makes sense that we see it high on the list to me. But maybe what's pushing the ratings down is that people don't really know how to deal with this sort of spree mechanic. It's maybe a little bit more difficult to parse and understand how it's going to play out and how often the different modes are going to come up. So maybe that's what's sort of pushing it in that other direction.
I love a good 2-mana counterspell, but for me, the other mode here being 3 generic mana means that it's going to come up very infrequently in a cube like mine. If your cube is a little slower and less efficient, then it might come up more often. And also, the fact that it makes an off-color token and it's a 2/2 white spirit creature token with flying instead of the classic 1/1 white spirit creature token with flying just makes it kind of aesthetically a big mess. So for me, it wasn't worth even considering this just because it's basically quench with maybe a, you know, 10% or 5% of the time upside. And that upside is not even one that I really like aesthetically. So maybe other people are in a similar boat. I'm not sure.
On the other hand, it is a common, and it is the most popular common from this set. And so if our respondents are adhering to a rarity restriction that, you know, like the pauper restriction, or if they're just hoping to pick this card up cheaply, then that might kind of inflate the card's reception.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's maybe worth mentioning that there are people that are playing these cards for a variety of reasons and also within a variety of restrictions. So we do often see a lot of the commons and uncommons rise up because that's very relevant to a big chunk of the people responding.
Well, I'll guess I'll read the next card. The 9th most popular card from this set is Aven Interrupter. This is 1 white-white for a creature bird rogue. It's a 2-2 flash flying. And when Aven Interrupter enters the battlefield, exile target spell. It becomes plotted. And then it has spells your opponents cast from graveyards or from exile cost 2 more to cast. Tested by over a fifth of our respondents, almost 22%, with an average rank of 5.8. It's not very highly rated, but it is kind of this known quantity of a flash white threat that is kind of interfering with the opponent's plan. It's not wearing a cowboy hat, so that's a plus, I guess.
That stood out to me as well. It's definitely easy to make the comparison to cards like Elite Spellbinder, or it even feels a little bit like Spell Queller, and then it's kind of just even often just delaying the spell might just have a big impact on the game. I feel like this is an interesting card. I'm actually more surprised to see this having so low a rating as opposed to the Phantom Interference.
I don't know. I'm not sure this card is as strong as some people might think. I mean, compared to Elite Spellbinder, for example, remember what Plotted does. It puts their card in exile, and they may cast it on a future turn for no mana. So even though it's taxing
sure,
it by two, they don't have to pay that base mana cost of whatever that spell is, especially compared to something like Spell Queller, where if they're able to remove this, then they can cast that spell for free. So in that sense, it's Spell Queller with nothing but downside. It's got a worse body. It allows them to still cast the spell at exiles for two mana instead of having to kill the thing first, and if they kill it, they still get to cast it for free. I'm not sure. I think it's very good against counter magic because the nature of plot is that a plotted thing has to be cast at sorcery speed. So if you hit a counter spell with this, it's essentially countered permanently. Beyond that, I don't know how powerful it is, and I'm skeptical that it's actually that great, especially compared to Elite Spellbinder and Spell Queller.
But what if you do cool stuff like counter your own spell with this?
That you can do. I think that's cool. Like if you opponent goes to counter your spell and you just plot it with Aven Interrupter, that's very cool because that tax only affects your opponents, even though you can in fact plot your own spell. So it does have cool lines like that. I appreciate that aspect of it, but I'm not surprised to see this at this point in the survey because I don't think it represents a ton of raw power. And while this survey is not about power level, oftentimes more powerful cards will be more appealing to more designers and will push a card further up than its play patterns might naturally lead to.
I also noticed that it's, as a 3-mana, you know, disruptive threat, it's still more reactive than something like Elite Spellbinder.
For sure.
Which kind of limits it, I would say, in aggressive decks. Like, yes, aggressive decks still want some amount of disruption, but I would prefer to be able to tap out for it and not have my value of my card dependent on what my opponent's doing. I would rather present the threat and let them answer those questions.
Yeah, something I've said before is that I really love sorcery speed removal specifically for aggro decks because you will so often be casting your removal or interaction at sorcery speed anyway because if you're going to be removing a blocker or making a creature unable to block, you're going to want to do that before you get to attack. And so the instant speed stuff tends to be really appealing for control decks, and the sorcery speed buff I really prefer for aggro decks because they're not really willing to pay the additional cost you're going to pay to make a spell an instant over a sorcery. And this being something that fundamentally only works at instant speed, or its ability only works at instant speed, is something that I think does mean that it's not really going to slot into an aggro deck very naturally.
Next up, we have Nurturing Pixie. This is 1 white mana for a 1-1 fairy rogue. It has flying, and when it enters the battlefield, return up to 1 target non-fairy, non-land permanent you control to its owner's hand. And if you do, you put a 1-1 counter on the Nurturing Pixie. So this is kind of a white main lion type card, but it's optional. But if you do it, you get a pretty powerful body for 1 mana. Otherwise, you can just have it be a 1 mana 1-1 flyer. This is being tested similarly by 21.8% of the people that responded, and also similarly a pretty low rating of 5.5.
I would say a really low rating, yeah. Like only slightly above the midpoint of the rating scale for a top 10 card is kind of unheard of. I have to check back our actual surveys to confirm that, but my gut tells me that it is extremely rare if it's ever happened before. So a card that maybe some people feel like they ought to like but don't like, or they feel like it's powerful but they're not sure if they like the play patterns, or maybe they like the play patterns but they're not sure if it's powerful. Not entirely sure why people are testing this card with relative high rates but are not that confident it's going to stick around in their cube. But
a lot of people feel very medium about this card.
Yeah, and I think this card is actually an interesting one for you specifically to talk about, Anthony, because I first read this and I was like, okay, cool, white main lions. Anthony loves white main lions, but what he loves about them is that you're taking a downside and turning into an upside. And this one is like a white main lion if it was designed by modern R&D, where they just said, let's take away any risk and also just make the upside way higher. Now you get a 1-mana 2/2 flyer instead of anything else.
Yep. Yeah, you summed up my thoughts exactly.
I'll still take Coruscant Fisher, personally, for my own taste.
Yeah, Coruscant Fisher's definitely... It's just an awesome card. Yeah, I mean, they've just rounded off all of those, like, that tension and that cost and that, like, need to build around it. You just have this, like, really easy fail case that, to me, is just much less appealing, but I guess... I get why this has more mass appeal and less potential frustrations of accidentally clicking on your land and picking up your land on Arena and stuff like that. So, sure, it's an easier-to-digest card, but it just doesn't have a lot of interest to me.
It does strike me as a... white main lion style card that could definitely see play in some of the highest power level cubes for that reason. You know, you pick up your Thraben Inspector, you pick up your...
I'm sure that this is a thing that will come up in a lot of subtle ways, like, oh, you exiled something with a Banishing Light and it was a token, so now you get to pick that up. Or there's, you know, we have Shock that's stapled to an enchantment or all kinds of little things like that. Like, there are a lot of ways to get value off of this.
Yeah, and then it being a 1-mana 2/2 flyer in an aggro deck, if you're getting any even... marginal value is going to be a really powerful card. So in the sense that maybe it is a pushed enough white main lion card to see play in the most powerful cubes, that's kind of cool. But yeah, from a like texture of the play patterns perspective, not the most interesting card to me either.
You could even play it on like turn one with a Mishra's Bauble or whatever.
Yeah.
As a 2/2, that is.
Yeah, with Mishra's Bauble, no downside. You just get a 1-mana 2/2 flyer. You even get to just cast a bunch of spells too on later turn by doing the same thing if you want.
However, I wonder, Coruscant Fisher has this amazing art that is really quite nice, whereas Nurturing Pixie has this horrifying little cactus baby. And I wonder if that's some component
really
to the low ranking.
It would be
for me personally, but hard to say.
It took me a long time to figure out what was even going on here. I was like zooming in on this card, like, what is this fairy even carrying? And then, yeah, it's a horrifying little cactus baby. Sorry, that sounds really judgmental to cactus people, but they're not real, so it's okay.
So, apology retracted. I will not apologize to the fake cactus people that are disgusting to me. All right, next up, we have the 7th most popular card from Outlaws of Thunder Junction. It is the 100 Ornithopter staple that everybody is talking about, Requisition Raid. This is another spree card. It's white to get your foot in the door, and then it has 3 modes, each costing a generic mana. Those modes are destroy target artifact, destroy target enchantment, and put a +1/+1 counter on each creature target player controls. It's being tested by 23% of our respondents with a rating of 6.8. I feel vindicated in the fact that my initial read of this card was that this seems really pushed for this type of effect, you know, comparing to like Basri Solidarity, which was not a powerful card by any stretch, but this is just pure upside over Basri Solidarity. And in a lot of cubes, there are artifact and enchantment matters themes, and being able to kind of squeeze another disenchant in there without having to dedicate a whole slot to it with a card that is still main deckable in just a traditional creature-based aggro deck is something that clearly is appealing to a lot of cube designers.
Yeah, I mean, this card is, I think, extremely powerful, especially at uncommon. Just the flexibility and having modes that do very different things is going to make it a card that's going to see a lot of play, I think. I do feel a little bit like similar to the fairy that, you know, they've just kind of made a card that is really easy to put in your deck and not really think about that much. And that sort of like lack of tension is, to me personally, less appealing. But yeah, I mean, I think that this will find many homes.
A lot of little decisions about it, too, just make it that much more powerful. Like, they could have easily given this 2 modes. One mode, destroy target artifact or enchantment. Another, put a +1/+1 counter on each creature. But instead, they gave you the option to, if your opponent has both, you can blow them both up. This can be a 2-for-1 plus a big buff to your team.
Or if you just really need to commit a crime and your opponents don't have any artifacts or enchantments, you can just give your opponents all the counters.
Weird that
seems
a crime,
like fake news.
But it is.
I believe that is all hat and no cattle in terms of that mode. Yeah, it's a nice card. I got nothing against it except the cowboy hats.
I do like that someone's riding like a chocobo-esque creature here, like big emus or like land-based birds. I like them.
I read that as a MOA, which there's precedent
for MOAs
that's in
exactly
Magic.
Exactly what it is. Yeah, never mind.
Damn, it's really chocobo. Too bad about the MOAs, isn't it?
We're definitely going to get chocobos in our Final Fantasy. I forgot we're literally getting a Final Fantasy extended IP product, and we're definitely going to get chocobos, and I'm a little excited for it. I'm not excited for the Buster Sword. That feels wrong to me. Chocobos feels right to me. I will not explain myself, okay? I'm vast. I contain multitudes.
Didn't they already make Enormous Energy Blade?
Yeah, but that's not actually the Buster Sword.
Okay, great.
I think that brings us to 3 steps ahead. This is another spree card, so a single blue mana gets you in the door. It's an instant. And the spree modes are If you pay one and a blue, you can counter target spell. If you pay three generic, you can create a token that's a copy of target artifact or creature you control. And you can pay two generic mana to draw two cards, then discard a card. It's tested by 23% of our respondents with an average ranking of 6.2. It's a counterspell or a cancel variant that's got this massive upside. I've also heard it described as Archmage's Charm and maybe Cryptic Command, but I'm not sure I believe that either.
So it's either cancel, clone, or is the last effect also something that is exactly an existing Magic card?
Yeah, that's a catalog, I think?
I don't know.
Oh, nailed it. Yeah, that's catalog, exactly, which is two and a blue for draw two, discard one.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another case where those are just three very different effects, so the fact that you can even do multiple is kind of nuts, but the flexibility, even if you could only choose one of those, is really strong.
This card and Requisition Raid both have these modes that are kind of like spread out and do different things, very different things. So it stands to reason that they're going to be useful in more situations. If you contrast this to a card that has like, you know, draw several cards, but then you can cycle it for one mana, well, both of those modes just draw cards. It's just a matter of degrees, right? But for Three Steps Ahead and Requisition Raid, the modes you choose are viable in very different situations, which I think increases the utility of the entire package.
I think something cube designers need to consider about these sorts of cards, which is a slight nuance to my own evaluation of them that I've come to better understand in recent years, is that for me, I do really like modal effects in general for the kind of gameplay I'm trying to cultivate. But there is a point at which the modality, which naturally comes at a cost, right? You're always paying a little more for that modality, so it's never going to be the most efficient version of a given effect, or very rarely. There's a point at which you end up just playing a bunch of inefficient modes where I think a lot of the excitement of cards kind of gets sapped out of them. So for me, like, a Cryptic Command is exciting because it's committal. I got to pay three blue to do it. It's hard to put in my deck. But the payoff is that it actually is modal and very efficient. And while this is arguably better in some senses because it is easier to cast, easier to put in my deck, and has different kinds of modes on it, for me, none of these modes are exciting to me. And even at the point that I'm casting multiples of these modes, it's just never going to be something I'm particularly excited about. And so I'm always kind of evaluating my modal cards through this lens of, like, is the trade-off here of efficiency worth it for the modes I'm getting? And for me, that's not the case on Three Steps Ahead and Phantom Interference and some of these other spree cards for my personal cube design goals, though obviously everybody out there has got their own.
It's a great point.
You hit a limit at some point where you're just like, if there's too much of this modal stuff, everyone's just playing really efficient, really kind of low-stakes magic where your cards always do something in your hand and they're never doing anything really efficiently because they're all so modal. And so you're just kind of like, it feels like decisions matter so much less on both sides of the battlefield when you just both get to always do something and that something is never that swingy.
It's kind of like the equivalent of the stereotypical peasant cube gameplay where everything is a Mull Drifter or a Gravedigger or a Ravenous Chupacabra, and you just end up trading on this very low efficiency exchanges. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison where you're getting this really high floor in exchange for never doing anything super efficiently. I think it's actually a very apt comparison.
Next up, we've got Harvester of Misery. This is a spirit for 3BB, 5 mana in total. It's a 5/4 with menace. When Harvester of Misery enters the battlefield, other creatures get -2/-2 until the end of turn. It also has the ability that you can pay 1 and a black and discard it from your hand and have one target creature get -2/-2 until end of turn. This is being tested by 23, almost 24% of our respondents, and has finally a somewhat higher rating of 7.2 out of 10. This card is also from the big score, which just means it has a different set symbol, right? That's all?
I think it also shows up in packs in a different rarity.
I don't
but...
care. This card seems, talking about modality, this is just another like very powerful modal card that can just be a 2-mana removal spell for a small creature, but it can also have this sort of like Massacre Worm type effect, so it's not surprising to see this tested by a lot of people.
I got to address a couple of my own comments on this card because I have gotten some...
Yes, please.
I've gotten some mail. Were you going to call me to task on this, Parker?
I was simply going to say that for Anthony, this card seems about as welcome as a rattlesnake at a square dance. That is all. Carry on.
So I mentioned that I'm really interested in this card in our set review for the Bun Magic Cube, which is my eternal, powerful, efficient cube. And I was called to task by our listeners who love to keep me honest for two reasons. One more obvious reason, which is that I fairly recently, when they printed Eliminate but Uncounterable, whatever that Long Goodbye, is that what it was called? Whatever that new removal spell is, that's the Uncounterable Eliminate. I went on a little mini rant about how I like my removal to be counterable. And then I mentioned in passing while analyzing this card that it has this channel ability, effectively a channel ability. It's not actually the ability channel, that removes a creature and can't be countered. And I think I said, and that's nice. And to be clear, that's not nice from a like gameplay perspective. What I was saying is that it makes it a little more powerful because you can't counter it. I would prefer if that mode was counterable. If there was a Harvester of Misery that both modes could be interacted with, I would like it more. Given that there's not, I am enough in love with this card design to tolerate that small annoyance. To me, like, just looking at Eliminate to Long Goodbye or whatever as a upgrade because it's uncounterable is a lot different than saying, here's a card that's complex, it's got a lot going on. And yeah, this is a downside of the card for me, is that it has this uncounterable mode, but I'm willing to accept that for all the other things this card is offering.
You're allowed to put Void Slime in your cube, though.
You absolutely can. You can also put the one that's just strictly better Void Slime that doesn't cost any green.
Disallow?
Yeah, disallow.
Mm-hmm. But it's not as cool.
It's not as cool, that's true. The other thing I have been called out on in this call-out culture in which we live is that I have explicitly avoided Troll of Khazad Dûm and a couple of other cheap cyclers from Lord of the Rings in my cube because I play Reanimate in my cube and I explicitly want it to be, the vast majority of the time, a quote-unquote fair Reanimate. I think if I had Reanimate and Troll in my cube, pretty often people would just cycle Troll on turn one, Reanimate it on turn two, and have a giant creature in play. And that's entirely doable within just the black color pie and really kind of violates my rules in my head for how I want tempo to work in my environment. I don't want you to be able to have a giant six mana creature on turn two, really under any circumstances in this cube. A similar thing is possible with Harvester of Misery, right? You could discard this card, kill a thing, and on turn three reanimate it, and then have your 5/4 menace that also wipes the board. Why I think it's more okay here is, one, it's a whole turn slower, which I do think matters quite a bit. A lot more can happen on turn three in this cube than can happen on turn two, so that's a big factor. The bigger thing for me, though, is that you need a target for the discard ability on Harvester of Misery. So either you're killing your own creature you played on turn one, or your opponent will have to play a creature you can kill, which is obviously pretty common here. There's a lot of cheap threats running around, so your opponent having a creature is not, you know, far-fetched or anything. But if you do, in fact, take that play pattern of, you know, end of your opponent's turn two, you discard Harvester of Misery, kill their creature, and then untap and reanimate it, what you're getting for reanimating it at that point, you're probably not killing anything else with that Enter the Battlefield ability, because it's only turn three, and you've already killed one of their creatures. So maybe you pick off another one, which is great, but you're almost certainly not killing anything else with it, at which point you're literally just getting a 5/4 menace, which, as far as cheap threats go in this cube, is not a problem, you know, compared to Troll, which has to be blocked by three creatures and is, you know, just much scarier in terms of its clock. You know, that's good, but it's not amazing. And it's not amazing enough that if I had Reanimate and Harvester of Misery in my opening hand, I would be hard pressed to imagine taking that line versus planning to do it later on in the game when my opponent has multiple creatures in play and I can sequence that while also holding a counterspell up or do something else on the same turn, because I wouldn't think it'd be worth it to try and get that early clock in at the cost of not getting the benefit from that Enter the Battlefield ability. So for those two reasons, I view this as pretty different from Troll of Khazad Dûm in how it relates to Reanimate, and I'm still excited about it, despite that potential play pattern to, you know, put a 5/4 menace in play on turn three.
And if you're not satisfied with Andy's rebuttal, you can write in and tell him.
You can send us a letter to our P.O. Box 4855, Baltimore, Maryland 21211. Did we lose Parker?
Well, no, I'm here. I just
you just hang up. You're like, he's talking much about Harvester of Misery. I don't care anymore.
Only a little bit. Yeah, card seems fine. I don't know. I might play it if I find one. Yeah, I don't know. I'm at this place where, like,
you don't have to have an opinion about every card. You can just not say anything if all you got to say is card seems fine.
Yeah, well, but also, I don't know. Modern Horizons 3 is coming out in, what, a month or two? And I haven't even finished getting the cards that I wanted from the last set to come out. And so it's like, when am I going to find time to get this and test this? And by the time I test it, it might be 6 months later because my group has grown enough that we're just not playing my cube every week anymore, which I love. But I just, the cost of this is so high and the chances of me getting to test it is low. So that's why I've been so quiet, I guess.
The cost in monetary terms, in
no energy,
energy?
And
the real, like, important costs.
Yes,
you could also just say what you think about the card even if you don't plan on acquiring it, because it is exhausting for you to acquire a card.
Well, that's the thing, it's less exhausting because I haven't thought about it.
There you go.
We could really shortcut this whole episode if we just
have to do this episode anymore if no one wants to talk about cards. That's totally fine. Again, I don't want to like phone in an episode if we don't want to do it.
I'm not phoning it in. I came up with this whole bit.
I appreciate the bit. We can just do the bit. We could just, you know, make jokes about the Wild West here for an hour instead of talking about cards if we wanted
we
to.
We should have just done a Wild Wild West watch. What do you call it? I don't know. We should have watched that
watch
movie.
Along.
Watch Along. Watch Along. A terrible movie.
We could also just watch a real good Western or something.
That seems less funny.
Yeah.
Well, I think MST3K has already gotten that niche filled in terms of watching a terrible movie and making jokes.
And they're the only ones that have ever done it.
I assume so.
All right, moving on. Our fourth most popular card from Outlaws of Thunder Junction is another card from the big score. It is Legion Extruder. This is one in a red for an artifact. When it enters the battlefield, it deals 2 damage to any target, and it has an activated ability for 2 and sacrificing another artifact. You can tap it and create a 3/3 colorless golem artifact creature token.
Speaking of shock on a permanent.
Yeah, this one was a little bit confusing during spoiler season because I think the first couple translations that came out about it were wrong. So just to confirm that activated ability one more time, it's 2 and tap it and sacrifice another artifact. You cannot sacrifice the extruder itself. But you can obviously activate it multiple times because you don't have to sacrifice the extruder itself. So in a deck that has other artifacts running around, this seems very strong. It's 2 mana for a shock, and then you get to just make a 3/3 at least once, and maybe more times if you have more artifacts to play off of. In Constructed, this seems really strong in multiples because you can just sacrifice the other Legion extruders that are not the one you're activating, which is quite good. I think if you have an Artifact Matters theme in your cube and you are aiming for playing at the peaks of power level, this seems like something you should definitely be considering.
I'm looking at this card and it just gives me Turbo Cube brain and I can't evaluate it correctly.
I think it would be very strong in the Turbo Cube.
I don't think it would be, is the thing.
I don't know. I mean, it's a free golem every turn, and also you love when people can actually play removal. And
it's true.
I think this would actually be a way people would pick off a Monastery Mentor or whatever, because this is main deckable removal. More than like your favorite 2 in a red removal, like burn spell, where you're like, why isn't everyone jamming flame spell in their deck? And it's like, because...
Oh, people can just pass them to me, and I will gladly put 2 of them in my deck.
I think this one's getting main decked a lot more often, which is
okay.
Maybe an upside to it in that cube specifically.
I wonder, though, I mean, in Turbo Cube, for our listeners, this is a cube where every spell and ability costs 2 less to activate or cast. A lot of the artifacts in that cube do end up going to the graveyard within one turn cycle. I'm thinking like Terrarion or any of the eggs. So maybe there won't be enough to sacrifice every turn. But I feel like manage to find 2 or 3 random tokens, like a food or a treasure or a clue... Well, actually, if it's a clue, you just sacrifice it and draw a card. So, I don't know. I guess I'm saying maybe there's a world where, sure, you can cast it and you can activate it for free in the Turbo Cube, but there's nothing to sacrifice.
There's definitely always random artifacts around. In fact, I think having more artifact sacrifice outlets would probably be upside. But, you know, depends. This is one very specific cube, and I think, yeah, a lot of the people that are rating this are testing it, not based on that, obviously, but just on the fact that it has an extremely high floor of just being a reasonable removal spell. There are a lot of people that have these sort of Artifact Matters themes, and it's cool that it just, like, asks you to have a different resource of random artifacts you want to sacrifice.
Yeah, I think that the Turbo Cube, a lot of the most identifiable or most powerful artifacts of a self-sacrificing ones, your various eggs and other power like that, but... I still think it's a minority of the artifacts that sacrifice themselves. Most of them just do a thing when they come into play.
And I guess I mention it because that way we might encourage Anthony to test a card from this set. But also, I do think even in cubes more broadly, artifacts incidental synergy is pretty easy to come by these days. We've got all kinds of cards. I'm thinking like Rabbit Battery as maybe a prime example there, where the 1/1 haste mode on that Rabbit Battery is perfectly fine, but it also happens to be an artifact, and it has this additional upside, which allows you to kind of incidentally support this artifact deck, even if you're not doing the kinds of like affinity for artifacts, 23 artifacts in your deck kind of thing. This could be you have 5 or 6 artifacts in your deck, and then a couple more creatures just happen to be artifacts. I could see this card finding a home in that kind of environment for sure.
Maybe. I do think at the highest power levels, I want a pretty dedicated artifact deck before I'm excited about this. I mean, 2 mana for 2 damage is fine, as Anthony said, but to compare it to something like Magma Jet, which I think is well outpaced in modern cubes, that's 2 mana for an instant that scries 2 and deals 2 damage to any target. I'm going to want to be making at least a golem out of this every time when I'm casting this card in my powerful cube deck, or I'm not happy with sorcery speed, 2 mana, 2 damage.
Sure. I guess there's always food tokens to sacrifice as well, and other kind of trinkets like that.
Yeah, especially I feel like we get tons of treasures these days. I feel like treasures become a very popular mechanic, especially in Commander, and so we see just a lot more cards that make treasure tokens somewhat incidentally. That's one I could see coming up pretty often. So yeah, it's a great example of a card that you can completely tailor to whatever power level you want. If you are playing at the peaks of power and you want this to be a great card, then you can support a fully all-in artifact deck that will always have things to sacrifice, and this just becomes a really powerful, repeatable threat with a removal spell stapled to it. Or you can play this in a cube where artifacts are like a sometimes treat. Like, this would be fine, I think, in the regular cube. I don't think it would be overpowered because you don't have so many artifacts that it's like you can make a deck that is completely all in on it. At least not in red, historically.
Fair. Yeah. That's an important point, that like the context is really going to matter for this card.
My hot take for Outlaws of Thunder Junction is that Legion Extruder is by far the coolest cube card in the set. Its most comparable cards are Bone Shards and Touch the Spirit Realm, and that it's a slightly below power maxed removal spell on its face, but it can double as a synergy piece in the right decks, giving a really dynamic role in drafts. However, unlike those two, Legion Extruder isn't a one-time effect. It's an engine that can repeatedly turn treasures, food tokens, or whatever into 3/3 threats for only 2 mana, making it a removal spell worth building around. Having a medium floor and a high ceiling means this card is going to be something that drafters are really going to want to speculate on.
Speaking of cards where the context matters, our number 3 most popular card from Outlaws at Thunder Junction is Bristly Bale Spine Sower. This is a legendary creature plant druid that costs 1 and a green for a 2/2, and it has the landfall ability. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, put a 1/1 counter on target creature, and it has the ability 3 green green, double the number of 1/1 counters on each creature you control. This is tested by over a quarter of our respondents at 27% and a rank of 7.2 on average. Now, this is another card where, depending on the situation of your mana base, whether you're playing fetch lands or not, bounce lands, another example, this landfall ability might be more or less relevant. And you can also tailor this to the amount and cost of removal in your format. If your removal is very expensive, then this thing can get 2 or 3 triggers before the removal can deal with it. So, this is a card I'm actually very excited about for my own high power cube, the Ship of Theseus. But I do think it can be tailored to fit a variety of power levels, which is no doubt a component of why it's number 3 on this list.
Yeah, people have been comparing it to Luminarch Aspirant, which is another 2 mana 2/2 that gives you a +1/+1 counter every turn. Bristly Bill, obviously not every turn, but also potentially 2 in 1 turn if you have fetch lands or other ways to double trigger landfall. So it's kind of like a Luminarch Aspirant that is more of a build around, more variable in its actual power level, but has a higher ceiling. I know there's been a lot of sourness around the flavor of this set, and I'll say that I kind of really like the creative direction and the art of these cactus people. I like the Bristly Bill illustration. I think it's very cool. The one thing I don't like is the name Bristly Bill. Like, I think if this thing had some other more like high fantasy name, I'd venture to say that maybe even Anthony would like it, even though he's been sour on the cactus people. I think what you don't like is that his name is Bill.
Oh, I Trust me, the name is doing a lot of work to make it to putting me off of this card for sure.
Anyway, I like the art. I think it's pretty beautiful and cool. I like the design of these cactus people. People are asking about this for the Bun Magic Cube. I think it would be fine. I don't know if it's worth all the complexity for me. It's going to eat a shock 99% of the time, I think, before it gets to do anything particularly interesting. While it's probably more powerful than Luminarch Aspirant in that cube, I think it's in a color that much less wants that effect or much less can benefit from that effect.
I don't know. You said it's complex, but really, I think a lot of the complexity is kind of emergent. Like,
it's only complex compared to Luminarch Aspirant, I guess is what I mean. Like, I love Luminarch Aspirant. It's just a, like, quintessentially clean card that is, like, so simple in its rules text and has lots of interesting emergent strategy. Like, where you actually put those counters matters a lot, depending on what kind of deck your opponent's playing and what kind of clock you want to present and how much you want to actually protect the Luminarch Aspirant as an ongoing value engine versus just make it a threat itself. That card, I think, is beautiful in its simplicity. It's not that Bristly Bill is, like, a super complicated card, but it's got a lot more going on that I think a drafter would look at in a pack and wonder, like, is there a plus one counter theme here I should be looking at? Like, does this activated ability, is this the reason I'm playing this card? Versus Aspirant, which I think is just so crystal clear.
I guess that's true. Obviously, the landfall ability is no barrier at all, because I think you play Tireless Tracker and landfall, yep, is just very common in general. I would prefer it without the second activated ability of doubling the amount of counters. Number one, because I don't want to let my drafters enjoy themselves. And number two, it does kind of create this different incentive where if you're planning to activate it, that means that you want to distribute your landfall triggers earlier in the game. And so it can actually change your decisions on the turns earlier if you want to, like, power through the most damage, which is kind of interesting. And I think I would prefer it if it were just raw stats without that kind of next level consideration. But even so, I'm very excited for it. It is the card of these top 10 that I'm testing in my own cube, and perhaps my favorite from the set.
I will say, I think activated abilities that are rarely going to be activated can sometimes be a kind of additive distraction that I have been critical of. But in the case of this card, I do really like mana sinks in green specifically, because that is a color that often can generate a lot of mana, at least in my own cubes and in many other cubes. And having a place to put that gives you a way to pay off those decks for making a bunch of mana without having to put 6, 7, 8 mana cards in your cube. So I actually don't mind it here. It just, I don't know, the whole package ends up being just not as resonant for me personally. And again, his name is Bill.
Bristly Bill.
Yeah, the Bristly doesn't, yeah, it's, we're both bad. Just Bill the guy. I don't know. Whatever.
Spine sewer? I mean, that's just like...
Spine sewer is cool.
What's the mechanics of sewing spine?
He's a spiny guy, and he sews them into your flesh.
Okay, that's not even how I read that word. Anyway, let's talk about the number 2 card tested by 36% of people that respond to the survey, Slickshot Showoff. This is a bird wizard. It's a 1/2. It has flying, haste. Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, it gets +2/+0 until end of turn. It also has plot for 1 and a red, so you can reserve it to cast it for free on a future turn. This just seems like a super, super pushed version of Kiln Fiend or a lot of these other cards we've seen before, that the classic spells matter payoff. The fact that it's flying is extremely relevant. That sort of makes these things that only pump their power a lot more powerful, and it kind of makes sense that in that style of deck where you're trying to sequence like a big turn and cast a bunch of spells and do something explosive, you can also take advantage of that plot, even though plot doesn't really do anything for this individual card other than give you some more control over when you're casting your spells.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I know y'all discussed this a couple episodes ago, but the plot ability for me is extremely interesting on this card and is maybe one of the best plot designs I saw in the whole card file. By the way, this is the highest tested plot card, and plot in general for this set was pretty favorably received among cube designers.
It's also one of the highest rated cards at an average of 7.7.
That's also true. I do think plot is, I might even go so far as to say, Wizards has found a genuinely good new mechanic that is creating a lot of interesting decisions, and I really value that. For example, for the show-off, I think y'all mentioned on the last episode that you can use the plot to spend your mana more properly, and you can not expose the show off to removal for a turn, and then you can cast it on the next turn along with a flurry of non-creature spells and just, like, get the opponent for six or more. However, I think that's it's not an auto decision to plot it. Number one, if you plot, you miss out on a turn of damage, possibly more if you have a Mishra's Bauble in hand, or if you know that your opponent is playing flyers and might have a blocker the next turn. So I think there is a subtle and very interesting decision there. Do I want more damage?
And if I may too, Parker, I think the other thing about plotting it is that if your opponent does have a removal spell and you plot it, then they will be ready with their removal spell, whereas they may have otherwise been tapped out on your turn two, and now you can sneak it in and at least get one hit in before it maybe eats that removal spell that it was going to eat anyway if you plot it and project your play for the next turn.
Exactly, and that's where I was going with other part of this nuance. That's all right. So I do think it is incredibly interesting decisions for this show-off. In that sense, I really like it. The only reason I'm not testing it myself is that it's already seeing some constructed heat and is a little bit expensive, and I'm not sure whether I just want to play one plot card or whether I want to spend some effort and test multiples, because it is a little bit complicated. But I do love the card, and I think plot in general is pretty well designed in this set and is resonating with a lot of designers.
Yeah, I mean, no surprise. I love this card, like I said in the previous episode. Super excited to jam this one in the Bun Magic Cube. It's definitely the card I am most excited for. I did want to call attention to the fact that this is the highest rated card in our top 10, but it is not the highest rated in the set. The highest rated by far is Arid Archway, which is the desert that taps for two colorless and bounces a land you control to its owner's hand on ETB. It's essentially like a colorless Ravnica bounce land with a little bit of additional benefit if you're bouncing a desert, which is only being tested by 4% of our respondents, but at a rank of 8.6, so the kind of card that some designers want and they really want it. And there's a couple of other lands, including two from the new dual land cycle that just enter the battlefield tapped and deal one damage to your opponent and are also deserts that are also getting higher ranks than Slickshot Show-Off. So even though we're talking about these kind of headline cards, there are deep in the file some cards with really high ratings, even though they're not being tested by a huge number of cube designers.
That's partly a quirk of the math. The fact that tens of people, like 20 or 30 people, are testing this show-off does mean that it's much harder to get a high ranking because a couple people will be sour on it and drag down the average.
Isn't it like 60 people that are testing it if it's a third of our 180 mm-hmm. respondents?
You know, cowboys can't do math, so I believe you're right.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when there's a really small number of testers relatively, you know, it's easier for it to have a higher rank because there's not a lot of people that are like, oh, Arid Archway seems fine and are going to, like, you know, rate it lower while still be testing it. But still, this doesn't happen on most surveys. A lot of times the most popular card or the card in the top 10 that is the highest rated is also the highest rated across the entire survey. So the fact there's a bunch of other cards that are popping up here, honestly, I think mostly speaks to the fact that at 7.7, none of the cards in our top 10 are super highly ranked for this set.
That's true. I think there's also an additional dimension that many of the cards rated higher are actually deserts. Desert cubes are a popular subtype of cube, and even besides that, there are people who just want to include that archetype in their cubes. But deserts have really only been printed, I think, in Amonkhet is the last time we got significant support for this archetype. So it may just be that the people who really wanted some new desert payoffs are finally getting it, and that's really driving their excitement.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I do want to note quickly for people that are listening that may not know what a desert cube is, that it doesn't actually necessarily have to do with the desert subtype. This is just a name for a cube where you have to draft all of your mana sources. You don't get to put basic lands in your deck at the end of the draft. But a lot of times, thematically, these cubes often have overlap with actual subtype desert lands and other similar themes.
The original one was called the Desert Cube and very much leaned into that. And so I think it's a prominent theme, but by no means prescriptive.
And that brings us to the number one card on our Cube Community Survey from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, which is Forsaken Miner. This is one black mana for a 2/2 creature skeleton rogue. Forsaken Miner can't block, and whenever you commit a crime, you may pay a black mana. If you do, return Forsaken Miner from your graveyard to the battlefield. As a reminder, committing a crime is anything targeting opponents, anything they control, and or cards in their graveyards. This is kind of a classic take on the recursive, one mana, unable to block black threat with set mechanic. We've seen many of these over the years.
Rattlebones with set mechanic.
And this is, I think, a very powerful entry. We rarely see these with two toughness. There's a fair number of two mana 2/1s over the years with this ability, your Grave Crawlers and your
Bloodsoaked Champions.
Bloodsoaked Champions at all. But this Escher point of toughness, I think, is a big difference maker in a lot of cube environments, especially ones where 1/1 tokens are common. You know, I haven't done the search on my own cube to figure out how common committing a crime is, but I would expect very common. And so, not surprising to see this quite high. And maybe a card I overlooked for my own Bun Magic cube, just because historically, those 1-mana creatures that are self-recurring tend to really only be cards that the hyper-aggressive decks want. But I could totally see this being a card that even a more mid-rangey black deck would be happy to have if it just keeps coming back over and over again and keeps putting pressure on.
Yeah, I think as far as those types of cards go, this is one that's pretty interesting to me because it does ask you to do something different. Like, you know, Bloodsoaked Champion asks you to attack. Gravecrawler asks you to have zombies. This asks you to do something different with the cards that you're probably already playing, and it might just lead to interesting sequencing decisions about, you know, maybe you want to keep a spell in your hand longer than you otherwise would so that you can get this trigger in the future. So I think this is a cool variation if you're interested in that type of card.
I agree. I think the crime mechanic is also fairly well designed and creates a lot of interesting space. This is not the only crime-centric card that is present in significant numbers on this survey. It is the top-rated, obviously, but anyways, crimes, I do think, have a lot of space, a lot of interesting decisions that are involved in committing crimes and deciding whether or not to rebuy this card versus using your resources in another way. I think this is a really neat design, and it's one that I will be playing myself in a different cube, the Pulp Nouveau cube, which I curate and involves a little more of a mining slash crime theme. So this is actually pretty good for multiple reasons in that format.
I didn't mention it, but this is being tested by 38% of our respondents, so a few more than Slick Shot Show Off, with a lower rating of 7.3, which is a pretty decent rating for a highly ranked card, but again, certainly not among the best we've seen. So we continue to see the diversification of cards from new sets that Cuban designers are interested in, which is great. Love to see it. Are there any other themes or specific cards we want to talk about from this set that were not in the top 10?
I would like to give one shout out to Tiny Bones, the Pickpocket. This is down, I don't know, in the 18% testing. This is a single black mana for a legendary skeleton rogue creature that's a 1/1 death touch. And whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you may cast target non-land permanent card from that player's graveyard. And mana of any type can be spent to cast that spell. Now, courtesy of our friend Deinonychus, I was able to play this card early in his cube. He had a version printed out, and so we got to play a little bit. I was visiting his neck of the woods. Anyways, we had a great time with this card. We were not at all certain how we would play, but the death touch combined with the attack trigger means that it is a very interesting decision whether or not to attack with this, and whether or not your opponent will block. And even though it has death touch, sometimes I found myself as Tiny Bones caster, I was thinking, maybe I want to spend my removal to make sure I can get a hit in, even though it could already kill a creature in combat. And so this is a really interesting nexus of decisions. I was able in several games to go, I was on the draw, and so I played Tiny Bones, and then my opponent played Thraben Inspector. And then rather than attacking with my death touch, I just killed the Thraben Inspector, attacked, and then took the Thraben Inspector for my own. So all that to say, I think it's powerful, and I think it's fun, which is a pretty great combination.
This is the one card in the set that I was kind of balking at the price tag a little bit. It seems like this is going to be a popular card for Constructed, maybe, or maybe it's just a card people like. But
yeah,
it's, I think at time of recording, priced around like $20 a pop. And I was interested in it, but I was not $20 interested in it, so I actually just placed my order for my Outlaws of Thunder Junction cards, and this was not included for that reason. But if reports continue to come in about how fun it is, I could see myself eventually shelling out for it.
I think it's one to keep your eye on.
I do love a one-drop that is worth protecting and clearing the way for. And also, anything that gets you to use a removal spell on Thraben Inspector is pretty cool. A card that you historically would never remove under any circumstances, because half the value, at least, is the clue they already got, and it's a one-drop. But If this is a card that makes you want to point a shock at Thraben Inspector, color me interested.
Yeah, it was great fun.
All right, Outlaws, are we done here?
I think we did.
I believe so.
Well, I look forward to reading your article, Parker, whenever you get around to writing it. Maybe in time for this episode, maybe not. But I value your perspective on this particular question, and I know that you are a thoughtful man, so I'm curious to see what you think about this when you have time to put pen to paper. You know, some things are just much better said in writing than on a podcast, when you can be very careful and precise about your language and, you know, edit it and all that kind of great stuff. So looking forward to that whenever you get around to it.
Appreciate that. And we will have the regular analysis article for the set review. And so you can view that when this podcast comes out. That will be available, as well as, again, Usman Jamil's personal set review of Thunder Junction.
And now we pour a little bit out for Parker for doing this voice the entire time. I really commend you for sticking to the bit.
What do you mean? Like finally stopping doing his accent he usually does?
I just took off the mask for the first time. It's all been a lie. Who caught me sleeping? No.
Are you going to do the outro too, Parker, or just the intro?
I'm done.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you to everyone for listening, and thank you to everyone for filling out the community set review so we can make this episode that we clearly all love and enjoy making and will keep doing until the end of time. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by Anthony, Parker, and I, thinking really hard about magic cards and then speaking into microphones about it. Thank you, boys.
It's been a real pleasure.
I'm so tired.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, dicks of various shapes and makeups.
No, stop it.
And textures.
Dag nabbit.
Slipperiness levels.
No.
Different levels of friction.
All that right. Joke has been written hard and put away wet. That's all I gotta say.